Welcome to the EcoNews Report. I'm your host this week, Alicia Heyman, Administrative Director for Friends of the Eel River. The EcoNews Report is an exclusive feature of KHSU, brought to you by the North Coast Environmental Center, publisher of our regional environmental newspaper, the EcoNews. Don't forget, you can find this show and other KHSU public affairs on the Radio Archives page at khsu.org or wherever you subscribe to podcasts. My guests today are Scott Greeson, Executive Director for Friends of the Eel River, and Samantha Canry, Board Member for Friends of the Eel River, Redwood Coast District Coordinator for Native Fish Society, Master's Student in Dr. Michael Miller's lab at UC Davis, and resident of the Van Dusen River. Hi, guys. How are you doing?
Good. Thanks for having us on, Alicia.
Yeah.
Hey, Alicia. Thanks for hosting.
Yeah.
Really appreciate it.
This summer, we've been talking about why the two dams on the Eel River, currently up for relicensing, should be decommissioned and removed. Today, we're going to continue that discussion and provide you, the public, information you can use when writing comments requesting dam removal. When the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, issued a scoping document for relicensing this project back in June, they did not list decommissioning as an official alternative. We're asking people to send comments to FERC by August 4th that requests that they list decommissioning as an alternative plan in the second scoping notice. In fact, in this first scoping notice, they offered no alternatives to relicensing the dam, which is something that we'll talk about later. Visit our website, eelriver.org, for instructions and assistance submitting comments to FERC. So we've raised concerns about dam safety and how problematic it is that documents related to seismic stability and emergency action planning and other dam safety issues are classified as confidential. Today, we're going to discuss the Eel River Dam's impact to native fisheries and the great potential that dam removal presents for fisheries recovery. Hydropower projects are issued 50-year licenses to operate. Scott, what did we learn about the last time this project was issued a license?
Well, that last licensing process started, if memory serves, in 1972. And I think the final license was issued in 1980 or so. And throughout that license, there was a lot of back and forth about the impacts of dam operations on Eel River fisheries. And when FERC approved that license, they did so saying that this was going to reduce the impacts on the fisheries and basically allow for them to be okay because they changed the schedule from the previously terrible flow schedule they had. By the late 1990s, salmon were listed up and down the West Coast under the Endangered Species Act, including the Chinook, Coho, and the Steelhead in the Eel River. And because of that listing, the National Marine Fisheries Service had to take a look at that license and what it said about how the river was going to be managed. And they said basically to FERC and the Pacific Gas and Electric, if you continue business as usual, you will drive salmon extinct in the Eel River. They issued what's called a jeopardy finding, which is the strongest tool that the National Marine Fisheries Service has under the Endangered Species Act. And what that meant was that FERC had no choice but to adopt what's called the reasonable and prudent alternative, which NIMS proposed, which is basically the fish biologist saying, this is the least you have to do to protect fish to be legal, to keep from causing them to go extinct. So that's the status quo right now, is a bad plan with these limits that say this is the least you have to do. Oh, and yeah, in the last 5 years of drought and attempts to manage under the RPA, we've learned that PG&E has decided that it really can't actually achieve what the RPA requires in drought years. There's not enough water to provide those flows. They haven't been able to control the pike minnow, which have invaded the system. So, in effect, PG&E has said they can't comply with the RPA.
Which was the bare minimum, really.
Exactly. And so now, status quo is a plan to prevent extinction that the agencies and the dam operators say they can't comply with. And this is what FERC tells us is not only the preferred alternative, the proposed idea on the table for relicensing is to just keep doing the status quo. It's also the no-action alternative, which FERC has proposed. So we have in their scoping document one, which, as you said, was issued in June, two alternatives to compare. which are exactly the same thing. Now, if the idea of NEPA is to compare alternatives and make environmentally superior choices so you can understand the impacts of alternative choices, the idea that we could do that without looking at actual alternatives is kind of hard to understand. And this gets to, I think, a longstanding problem with FERC, which is that as an agency, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission is a great example of what academics call the Iron Triangle, where political power at one apex of the triangle combines with agency power at another angle and industry power at another, and makes for a relationship that's very hard for people on the outside to break into. Here, the relationship is between the hydropower industry, the agency that regulates it, FERC, and Congress that makes the rules that FERC has to follow. Unlike every other federal agency, though, FERC doesn't like following the National Environmental Policy Act, NEPA, which says you have to look at the environmental consequences of a federal action. And what we're seeing in the scoping document is entirely consistent with FERC's long practice of ignoring environmental impacts, of refusing to balance energy production with fish and wildlife and natural resource protection.
So back in the year 2000, a lot of these federal agencies got together in something called the Interagency Task Force. Can you tell us about what they did and what that
right.
was about?
Right. So the federal agencies, basically, you know, the Park Service, the Forest Service, as well as the federal wildlife agencies like NIMS or the Fish and Wildlife Service, they all have to deal with NEPA, too. And they were looking at FERC and saying, basically, you know, this is crazy. You don't follow NEPA. You have to look at alternatives. You have to look at dam removal alternatives. Let's get together and at least agree on what the process is supposed to be. And in 2000, as part of an attempt to reform FERC's relicensing process for hydroelectric dams, basically to deal with the fact that FERC was rubber stamping dams relicensing proposals and then having this endless decade-long fights at the end of their relicensing processes, the agencies are saying, hey, address the impacts up front, deal with them in the environmental impact analysis, and then we'll have it on the table and we can see what we need to do. So they agreed together in this document that's a task force report that basically says what FERC will do with respect to decommissioning. The document says, we've identified factors, and then they note 17 of them, that FERC will look at in deciding whether a more thorough analysis of decommissioning is warranted. And like I said, the other federal agencies all thought that dam decommissioning should be the default. It should always be on the table. Well, the 17 impacts start with listed threatened or endangered species, the viability of a project, including the costs of resource protection measures. Third is the river targeted for fish recovery. Four is there feasible fish passage. This is all about the impacts that are front and center in the eel. If you wouldn't propose dam decommissioning on the basis of these factors in the Eel River, it's really hard for me to see where you'd propose it. You might not have proposed it in the Elwha, where they've taken the dams out. The thing is, though, FERC didn't even look at this. They didn't even talk about these factors. Scoping Document 1 says nobody proposed decommissioning, so we're not going to look at it. And besides, right. It's a clean, safe source of great power and water.
So let's briefly talk about some of these factors.
Yeah.
Are there listed threatened or endangered species in the eel?
Oh, yeah. Chinook salmon, coho salmon, steelhead. Yeah. And we've been talking about those in our previous programs. And again, as you noted at the beginning, we had conversations with Darren Maru from Caltrout in our last two Eco News Report broadcasts, which were the beginning of June and the beginning of May. And we talked at some length about why these fish are threatened. And a lot of the problem is lack of habitat, lack of access to good breeding and rearing habitat.
Hmm. Well, what about the third factor that's listed? Is the river targeted for fish recovery?
Indeed, yes. And again, you know, if they look at the National Marine Fisheries Service's recovery plans, at the state of California's coho recovery plan, because the coho are listed under the State Endangered Species Act as well, yeah, the eel's front and center. In fact, we've been talking about the need to protect the eel as a kind of safe harbor for steelhead since the 1940s,
wow.
When California Department of Fish and Game biologist named Leo Shapovalov said, hey, this river is really important, and these fish are really extraordinary, and we could protect them here while we're losing them in the rest of California. So, you know, it's not a new idea, but it's still a good one.
Yeah, it's a special habitat. So what about feasibility of fish passage? And there are two dams up there.
That's right. And we got the Cape Horn Dam is the lower dam that actually provides for the diversion tunnel that takes water over to Potter Valley on the headwaters of the Russian River, which is why they call it the Potter Valley Project. And there is a fish ladder that goes over the Cape Horn Dam. But that fish ladder has been improved like 6 times now, I think. And there are still a lot of problems with it, including the fact that in high flows, the screens that keep sediment and especially debris out of the fish ladder and keep it from clogging up themselves get clogged up. And so this year, for example, because we had pretty high flows on the river, the fish ladders were out of commission going downstream for 51 days in February. So even though we can provide access up sometimes to some degree for salmon when we have enough water to provide for those flows in the fish ladder, that ladder doesn't necessarily work all that well. There's a lot we probably ought to do to make that fish passage better. Mm-hmm. The real problem, though, is that the upper dam, 12 miles up from Cape Horn, is Scott Dam. It's 140 feet from the bottom to the top of its gates, and it's technologically possible, we think, to have a fish ladder at that size. That means 1,400 feet of linear run to get up 140 feet of vertical run, but it would be extremely expensive, and there's absolutely no guarantee it would actually work. So yeah, there are some real problems with fish passage. Mm. Having said that, the federal law now clearly requires fish passage. So does state law, unless it's completely infeasible. So that's one of those questions you need to look at when you're considering the economic viability of a project if you have resource protection measures in place. If you're really protecting the fish, does this thing work when it only makes, you know, 9.2 megawatts of power at its maximum, which is never?
Yeah. Another interesting thing to note about the fish passage, particularly at the smaller dam, Cape Horn Dam, is the other species that are trying to pass the dams. And as all three of us saw last month when we visited the project, was that the lamprey can't really utilize that fish ladder.
It's amazing that they're using it at all in some ways because, you know, until a few years ago when the state and federal fish agencies put some block water, some fish protection water down the dams to encourage fish migration out of young salmon and steelhead, they got a pulse of lamprey coming back up at that point. Until that point, we hadn't really seen lamprey using that ladder in any substantial way. And so the folks who run that ladder, the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, started modifying it to make it possible for lamprey to get up. And now they've actually set up a system that I call it the lamprey habit trail. It kind of looks like the world's longest dryer exhaust tube running all the way down kind of alongside the salmon ladder. And that's the lamprey tube. And that seems to be working a lot better. But again, this is after 90 years of one dam and 105 years of another dam. We're finally starting to provide access for lamprey, which are a pretty important species in the river that was named for lamprey.
Yeah.
And they've had lamprey coming up through the fish ladder, I believe, 11 out of 12 months in the last year.
Right.
Just now that passage has been available for them.
Right. And so there needs to be water coming down. And part of that is that we've had a wet year. So there's attraction water.
But they hadn't seen lamprey going up the fish ladder until just a few years ago.
That's my understanding. It was a real shock. And we all remember the note that Scott Harris had collected a garbage can full of lamprey and taken them up and over the dam and dumped them in before they modified the ladder. Yeah. And some of this may have to do with lamprey's biology, that they're getting the pheromone signals that they rely on to attract them up into a watershed now because there are young lamprey above the dams.
If you're just tuning in, this is the EcoNews Report on KHSU. I'm your host, Alicia Heyman, Administrative Director for Friends of the Eel River. And with me are Scott Greason, Executive Director for Friends of the Eel River, and Samantha Canry, a board member for Friends of the Eel River. So we're talking about the really interesting species, Pacific lamprey, and how they interact with the dams. But there's another interesting species I'd like to talk about, and that's the summer steelhead. Sam, you've been doing some work monitoring the summer steelhead and the eel. What can you tell us about these really unique fish?
Yeah, summer steelhead are pretty amazing. For those of you that don't know, in the Eel River, we have two runs of steelhead, winter run and summer run. So the winter wren enter the river late fall through late winter and spawn and then return out to the ocean. The summer wren enter late spring into the early summer and then spend all summer in deep, cold pools awaiting the fall rains to gain access to their natal spawning habitat, and then spawn fall through the early winter and then return out to the ocean. So on the Eel River, we have extant runs of summer steelhead in a pretty sizable run in the Middle Fork and a smaller run on the Van Dusen River.
By pretty sizable, you mean?
The average has been about 800, but for
on the
northern
Middle Fork.
On the Middle Fork, yeah. And on the Van Dusen, it's been around 150. But yeah, sizable for Northern California.
For summer steelhead.
For summer steelhead in Northern California. Not sizable for historical numbers by any means, yeah.
So you found them on the Middle Fork and on the Van Dusen, and we like to think that there's potential habitat for them up above the dams. What can you say about that?
Yeah, so above the dams, there's a lot of cold water. We've been monitoring some temperatures up there and have found a huge amount of really cold water, seeps, springs, and snowmelt coming off of this Snow Mountain wilderness and some of the other headwaters tributaries. And there's a couple small sets of roughs that could potentially create the habitat where, you know, that usually separates winter run steelhead and summer steelhead. There's historical anecdotal evidence of summer steelhead being up there, but we're in the process of beginning a genetic study to look at if we can get the evidence of the summer run genotype having been up there historically.
Now, wait a minute. How do you do that? You look in bone middens for old bones?
Theoretically, that has happened in other places. But
that's not what you're...
No, I mean, it would be great if we came upon some old middens. I haven't heard of any known sites of those on the upper eel above the dam. Has been done in other places.
Right. But what you're going to do here is exploit the connection between summer steelhead and rainbow trout.
Yeah. And just...
So tell us about that.
Well, so the trout that are still living up above the dam are the descendants of trout as well as steelhead that were able to pass above the dam before.
But you said steelhead. Why are we talking about steelhead and trout at the same time?
Steelhead and trout are the same species.
No.
Yes.
It is. It is true. Steelhead.
So what's the difference?
It's a morphological difference.
What's that mean?
It means that there's some mechanism that certain individuals decide to stay in the river and have a, you know, river life history, and others decide to go back out to the ocean and have an anadromous life history. And a lot of that is being studied.
But it's all a lifestyle choice.
I guess you could call it that. I think it's a little more than, you know, what we think of as lifestyle choices. So yeah, steelhead can have rainbow trout offspring, and rainbow trout can have steelhead offspring.
So really, they're the same species. And by looking at rainbow trout in the upper basin above the dams, who still survive above Scott Dam, even though they haven't been to the ocean in 100 years.
Yeah, you can see evidence of the summer steelhead genotype from their ancestors.
That is so cool.
It is impressive. You know, one thing I also find impressive is the great lengths that people like you go to do this work. Can you tell us about what it's like when you go looking for summer steelhead, say, on the Van Dusen? How much hiking you're doing? What kind of effort you're putting forth?
The Van Dusen is a really special, special case. Yeah, there's a lot of private land there. So to get access, the way that we've been doing it is public access, but it's separated by a good number of miles, close to 20 miles. And so we just dive the whole stretch in between there, diving all the holes that are deeper than 6 feet looking for adult summer steelhead. And then for up above the dam, we're just getting tissue samples of the juvenile fish and looking at those, which is easier. You can just go, you know, spot check different areas where you think there would be a lot of juveniles that could have that genotype still.
Great. So Mike Miller is the lead author on a study that shows the summer steelhead and spring run Chinook genetics and how they differ from their later run cousins. We saw a presentation that he did a little while ago about how that gene came to evolve in these fish. Can you talk with us a little about that?
Yeah, I think, you know, the exact event that occurred that caused the divergence of the two species hasn't really been researched. But previously to his and some of his students' research, the theory was that winter run steelhead and summer run steelhead, as well as fall Chinook and spring Chinook, were more closely related to each other within the same basin than they were to, you know, first steelhead than to summer steelhead in another watershed. And so the idea was if the summer steelhead or the spring Chinook were to be extirpated from that watershed, that they could relatively quickly, that their niche could be refilled by fall or winter run fish within that same watershed.
But that turns out not to be the case.
Yeah, but his more recent research has shown that there was actually evolutionary events millions of years ago that caused this divergence. And, you know, they were random events, and they're not, as you might imagine, likely to happen again in any sort of reasonable timescale. And that once those fish are gone, their genotype is gone.
So would you say that makes it all the more important to focus on these fish and preserve them?
Yeah. I mean, as a from a genetic perspective, that's pretty clear evidence. From a personal perspective, I think a lot of people that have spent time diving with these fish already recognize that you know, they have a very different life history, and they're clearly different fish, and they're worth preserving. And this genetics just shows that more specifically.
Yeah.
So the point to note here is that under current law and regulation, we have the winter and summer steelhead in the eel lumped together as a single species,
right,
by the National Marine Fisheries Service. So they're listed as threatened, which means they're at risk of becoming endangered in the next century. That's what the law says.
Yeah.
But if we were to look at summer steelhead and winter steelhead as distinct entities, as different species under the meaning of the Endangered Species Act, which I think that's what this genetic research tells us, then those population numbers you described, Sam, don't look so comforting anymore.
No, and they're really critically endangered.
Yeah. So we're talking about summer steelhead and spring run Chinook, where they do exist, being really very, very much imperiled. So critically endangered summer steelhead puts a different picture, really, and before us in terms of both what we need to do to protect the watershed and what the opportunity to remove the Eel River dams means for restoring that upper basin habitat.
Right. You know, new research has found that upper basin habitat actually consists of more like hundreds of miles of potential spawning and rearing habitat for anadromous fish than previously thought.
Yeah, those are larger numbers than we'd seen before, but it confirms the sense many professional biologists have had that, yeah, there's a lot of good habitat up there.
Yeah.
And as you said, there are, in fact, healthy populations of rainbow trout up there, which suggests, again, that steelhead would do fine as well.
Yeah, and a lot of cold water.
Yeah. So what do we need to do to get the summer steelhead recognized and protected? That's actually a question for me.
That isn't that involve some legal issues with the National Marine Fisheries Service?
Yeah, we're going to have to petition to list under the Endangered Species Act. And then when they say no, we're going to have to say, but look at the science, Your Honor. And the court will have to order them to look at the science, and then we'll be off.
Yeah.
So we talked a little bit about what makes these fish special. Well, we talked a lot about what makes them special genetically. And I'd like to just touch on the human interaction. You know, obviously right now we're not out there catching summer steelhead. But, you know, are these fish different when they come into the river from the ocean? Are they physically different? Are they, do their young grow at a different rate? Like what is really different about these fish in the way that the average person is seeing?
Yeah, so I mean, the main difference is that the summer fish enter the river with a large amount of fat stored and sexually immature. The fat storage is so that they can survive the many months where they're not really going to be eating very much in the river. And sexually immature, as opposed to the winter run fish that enter sexually immature and spawn very quickly and return out to the ocean. So this is obviously a pretty dramatic difference just in physiologically speaking. I'm not sure about the exact, you know, rate of growth of the young. I don't know that that has been extensively researched. I would imagine that there are some differences, you know, they're potentially spawned in different areas and at different times, mm-hmm. slightly different times, and so there probably would be some difference in the growth rates.
One thing I found really notable in Mike Miller's presentation was this idea that in an intact watershed, one that hadn't suffered a lot of industrial human disturbance, those early run fish, the summer steelhead, the spring run Chinook, would actually have a real reproductive advantage
right.
from getting into habitat that other fish couldn't use. And so that kind of lines up with this idea that in the Klamath, for example, the spring run Chinook were probably the larger run
right.
than the fall run. But the impacts of our actions on the land seem to fall disproportionately on those early return fish. And Sam, maybe you can just point out why that would be.
Yeah, so the early returning, or the premature migrating, which the summer or spring run fish, they are a lot more dependent on cold water because they're, you know, spending all summer in the river as adults, needing the temperatures that all salmonids need, you know, below 68 or 70 degrees Fahrenheit.
And they're good eating.
And they're good eating. Yeah, they're a lot more, they're a lot easier to catch if you were
inclined to do so. Well, so they'd be subject to predation.
Predation,
as well as human.
Poaching, predation. But primarily, I think it's the temperatures and the, you know, reduced available good habitat in the summertime from human disturbance.
Yeah. So one other ecological factor I'd like to touch on in the river, back to that interagency task force and their list of all the factors that we should be considering. One factor a little farther down the list was water quality issues, including the presence of toxic sediments. Now, this is often a problem that we find in reservoirs. Scott, is that a problem that we find in the eel, too?
Unfortunately, it is. And often, these kinds of problems are a consequence of mining activity. You can see that on the Trinity, where there's historic gold and mercury mining. And so we've got real questions about the mercury burden that's accumulating in sediments, but then ultimately coming into the fishes. And so we've got to be concerned about people who are eating a diet that's heavy in those fish. On the Columbia, we have major mines in Canada that are dumping toxic heavy metals into the Columbia. But on the eel, on the upper eel, it looks like what we've got is a problem of not so much of mining, but of ores which contain mercury being submerged in the Lake Pillsbury Reservoir behind Scott Dam. And what happens here is that the mercury, when it's exposed to water in anoxic conditions without oxygen, can become methylated mercury, which is an incredibly neurotoxic form of mercury that accumulates in animal tissues. And so it'll get into the food chain with very small animals and then accumulate in the bodies of animals as it goes up the food chain. And unfortunately, in, I think it was 2009, a sampling program that is being conducted in various California lakes and reservoirs caught a small largemouth bass, like it was about 500 millimeters long, that had the highest level of mercury in its tissues reported in the state of California for that period. Yeah, it's really bad. And, you know, that's not to say that we have that problem in the eel overall, but we clearly have it with this reservoir. And so one of our concerns is, are we creating this problem by having the reservoir in place, by operating these dams? And second, if we are going to decommission and remove these dams, as we should at least consider, you know, and it's an alternative, what does that mean in terms of what you have to do to treat that sediment? Do you have to actually remove it physically? Or can you have some of it go down the river and some of it get revegetated in a way that, you know, isn't really hazardous for fish and wildlife?
Right. These are all really important questions that we're hoping will be investigated in the course of the next few years as we go through this relicensing process. Folks, if you're interested in being involved in this process, please visit our website, eelriver.org. We've got an action page where you can find instructions and assistance, filing comments to FERC. Please ask them to include decommissioning in their second scoping notice. And, you know, whatever else you have learned from us and from others about the Eel River and their fisheries and the safety of those dams, you know, just put it in your own words and ask them to do what's right. This has been the EcoNews Report. My name is Alicia Heyman, and I've been your host for the past half hour. I was speaking with Scott Greeson from Friends of the Eel River and Samantha Canary, also from Friends of the Eel River. If you have any questions or comments about this program, please call our listener comment line at 826-6089. You can hear this broadcast again on the archived programs page of the station's website at khsu.org or as a podcast wherever you subscribe. The EcoNews Report is produced at Humboldt State University in cooperation with the North Coast Environmental Center. Tune in again next week at this same time for the EcoNews Report.